Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures, telling stories of Texas history and heritage from diverse cultures that define the state's unique character for over 50 years. Details at texancultures.utsa.edu.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. In the months before an election, journalists and candidates alike turn to polls and survey statistics to gauge public opinion on candidates, politics, and policy. And political junkies look at polling to try and figure out how elections could turn out. But some say political polling is all fake. They say it's smoke and mirrors. So how are opinion polls conducted? How credible are the results? Are you watching the latest news on political polling? How much credibility do you give them, particularly now with this major general election just a few months away? And the poll results, well, do they calm your nerves or do they make you all the more anxious? You can call in, tell us how you're dealing with the polling data that you see and questions you have about how they were conducted, how they get those informations. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And you can email us at thesource@tpr.org and tweet at us at @tprsource. We're joined this hour by Rob Santos. He's the Vice President and Chief Methodologist at the Urban Institute, President-elect of the American Statistical Association, and former President of the American Association of Public Opinion Researchers. And Rob Santos, good to have you, sir.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Also with us is Trent Buskirk. He is a professor of data science and the chair of the Applied Statistics and Operations Research Department at Bowling Green University. Trent Buskirk, good to have you. Welcome aboard.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Thank you. It's good to be here as well.
Also with us is Scott Keeter, the senior survey advisor for the Pew Research Center. Scott Keeter, good to have you today, sir.
Thanks, Doug. Good to be with you.
So, Rob Santos, we see a lot of people. They read the polls on the news, on, you know, on the 24-hour news cycle. They bring out these polls. They talk about how these things are shifting, and this is big, and this is big, and this is a gold standard poll. How much weight should the average voter or person who's watching give these polls?
That's a great question, and because it turns out that there are a lot of different ways that polling can be done, especially with new technologies, online polling, and so forth. Because of that, I always say that the consumer should be aware, just like buyer aware, be aware, consumers should be aware. Typically, the gold standard types of polls are those that have probability sampling, something called probability sampling, where they take groups of registered voters, a known commodity, sample them, and then make an effort to contact them either through a variety of ways, often by telephone and others, and then make the appropriate adjustments based on the responses they receive, because nowadays people are very wary about privacy and issues like that. So the bottom line is I basically say buyer beware or consumer beware. Don't totally take all of these results to the bank. Know that there is a lot of variability depending on things like how you answer the question or the types of questions being asked, the types of response options you're given, how the sample was drawn, who it is that you're talking to, is it general population, registered voters, somebody in between, and the purpose for what the poll is trying to do. Are they trying to forecast a winner? Are they simply taking a pulse of what's going on from time to time? So bottom line, buyer beware.
So Trent Buskirk, that means that so often it's up to the media to present these complex polls in a way that the average media consumer who will be watching cable TV or listening to the radio can pick up, and they see these numbers, and they may not hear all of the nuance. So there's a lot of opportunity here for over-interpretation, misinterpretation of these results?
Certainly. It's really interesting There are several resources that are available to help members of the journalists community in order to vet and understand numbers that they report. Cyline.org, S-C-I-L-I-N-E.org, is a nonprofit organization that really helps journalists to do a little bit of the background work. What's really interesting about numbers is that they sound so factual. You know, if we say that Trump has 45% support, it doesn't seem subjective at all. It seems like that's 45% support. And they don't really get investigated like other allegations or other stories that might have a great lead or a great byline. And so we often sort of say, I mean, to Rob's point, you know, being able to sort of vet these numbers is becoming more and more important now, especially as the number of ways that people generate data, the number of sources that are available, and the methodologies people use are not all created equal, and there's worth in asking more questions about how the number was derived. You know, interestingly enough, Rob's point about there are multiple polls, and the numbers can shift, even a 2 or 3 day span can shift the numbers in a race that's really tight. So one thing to think about is there are new things like poll aggregation, for example, that look at smoothing or basically averaging or aggregating multiple polls that are aimed at the same outcome or the same political race or over the same time period in order to smooth out some of that variability that we see in the numbers. But frankly, it's important to ask, does the number represent only one poll or does it represent multiple polls? Is the number coming from a probability source or some other source? How was the information collected? And what's the denominator of that statistic? Is it registered voters? Is it all voters? Is it all residents? This matters in terms of how much credibility you can place in the number and how you report it, frankly.
Scott Keeter at the Pew Research Center. This is the big question that people say polls got it wrong with the 2016 presidential election. Had the polls been right, we would be having a re-election for Hillary Clinton today, and we're not. Did the polls get it wrong in 2016?
That's a great question because there are two answers, yes and no. So they definitely got it wrong in some of the states where it really mattered. Some of the state polling was terrible and left the impression that Hillary Clinton, for example, was going to win Wisconsin, was going to win Michigan, and was going to win Pennsylvania, and those polls were simply wrong. We know, as a result of an autopsy conducted after the fact, that some of those polls were wrong because of failures to do things that most good pollsters do routinely, which is to weight the data properly to make sure that they match the public in terms of demographic characteristics, most importantly, education. But there's also an answer to the question that is no, the polls didn't get it wrong. If you look at the average of the national polling that was done in 2016, the national polls were quite accurate. They missed Hillary Clinton's margin in the popular vote by only about one percentage point. And so you have a kind of tale of two cities here. You have evidence that the craft of polling can still do a good job, and there's a lot of systematic evidence, not just from the United States but from around the world, that polls continue to function well. But then you also have instances, and important instances, where polling that's not done right can give you the wrong impression and lead people to expect an outcome that they didn't get, and they were shocked, and rightly so.
All right, so we're going to be talking more about that, and we're talking about polling science, how much faith you should have in it. The number is 833-877-8255. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Opinion polls vary enormously in structure, style, and credibility. They're easy to miss or even overinterpret, and they take on extra weight the closer we get to a major election. You see election polling become part of the 24-hour news cycle, the latest one being announced, and then you get reaction to it, and sometimes you get people who are in the White House saying that poll is fake and is not even credible. Even recently, we've had the President of the United States, Donald Trump, sending a cease and desist letter to CNN over a poll that showed Trump trailing former Vice President Biden by 14%. And since that letter was sent, more polling has come out showing that Trump is trailing, falling behind all the more further behind Biden. How much stock should we put in this polling data? What does it mean, particularly now that there's still a lot of time left between now and November the 3rd? Anything can happen. If you have a question or a comment about these polls, how they're conducted, have you ever been polled? Do you feel like you were treated fairly? And have you wondered why you have never been polled? The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Rob Santos with the Vice President and Chief Methodologist at the Urban Institute. A lot of people say they didn't ask me. I have an opinion, but no one ever called me up and asked me what I thought about the president.
That may very well may be true for a large portion of the population. And the reason is that we don't need statisticians, pollsters do not need to talk to every person in the U.S. or every registered voter in the U.S. in order to find out in general what's going on with regard to specific candidates. There is something called statistical sampling theory, and it demonstrates that if you take a probability sample, if you draw a portion of the sample in the certain of the population in a certain way, you can actually draw insights and gain knowledge about the overall population.
So that's basically, actually, that means kind of if I take a teaspoon of the pot of soup and I taste it, I have a pretty good idea what that soup tastes like.
Pretty much. And it's done actually for most of the things that matter in this country with the federal government. Things like what's the eligibility for food stamps, how much for a meal program, how much federal funding do states get. Those are often drawn from are decisions that are made on the basis of samples rather than a census of the whole population. Now, the census is important, and we all should. If you haven't yet done your 2020 census, you definitely need to be doing it now because you deserve to be counted and get all the federal funding and political representation you deserve. But having said that, sampling has to be the way to go about this because it would be too unworkable otherwise to try to constantly get censuses of people with regard to polling.
Trent Buskirk at Bowling Green State University. What is an appropriate sample size? I hear criticism of polls saying the sample wasn't big enough. What does a gold standard poll need to have?
So that's a really interesting question, and it seems like it's a simple one, but it can be a more complicated one in part because of the underlying populations that we care about, right? So let's say, for example, that you live in a rural community and you wanted to know who people were going to vote for the mayor of that community. If you had 500 people who lived in that community, a sample size of 1,000 would be too many because you would run out of people. A sample size of less than 500 would be adequate, as Rob suggested. So it really matters in terms of the population that you care about. Sort of local polls would have different sample sizes that would be representative than, say, national polls. But if all things were equal, if we're talking about national polls, for example, in a population as large as the U.S., we typically can see telephone or random digit dial polls that are randomly selected from telephone banks of about 1,200 or so people, giving us about a margin of error of around 3 percentage points. So that would mean that we would be able to sort of predict who is winning a race with about a 3% margin. And so, but that number factors into a few things, factors in the size of the population that we care about, the U.S. It also factors in conservatively what we think it's a neck and neck race. So in the case of Biden and Trump, where it may not be so close, you may not need as large of a sample size in order to get a margin of error of that accuracy. But the sample size question is a tricky one, and there's a lot of things that go into that, not just pulling out a number of a hat or 30, if you will, as many people might suggest. So it's a bit more involved in that. Having polls report their sample size and also report how many people respond to their requests for polling is an important consideration. If a poll doesn't report their margin of error, it's hard to track back how big the poll was in the first place. So these are all things that go into evaluating the polls and the sample size question that you ask.
Scott Keeter at Pew Research Center, we frequently hear this, and tell me if it's true or not, that you only poll with these live interview polling people with landlines. Does that happen?
Oh, no. That used to be the case because, 20 years ago or so, everybody had landlines and hardly anyone had a cell phone. But today, if you're doing a phone poll, you should be calling a majority of cell phones and not a majority of landlines. And over the years, most reputable pollsters have made that adjustment. And so if you look at some of the major telephone polls around, you will see that 60, 70, 80% of their interviews are done with people on cell phones because a majority of the country now doesn't have a landline, just has a cell phone. But there are other ways of doing polls, of course. There are online surveys. And so, for example, at Pew Research Center, we've almost stopped doing telephone surveys because they've become extremely expensive to do. And so we now do our surveys using what's called a panel. That is a group of people that we have recruited using probability methods to take our surveys, and we interview them online.
But there are people who have online polling, and we hear them, and you have to wonder if that is just a website where you can click one thing or another, Scott Keeter, and that means, well, these individuals, they have access to the internet, and they frequent this website, and so this is not something that's really indicative of anything other than people that go to that website.
Well, that certainly would be a problem if that was the way we were doing it. But
there's some disreputable people that do that.
Oh, yes, there are. And it's one of the things that I think Rob said in the beginning is that there are just a lot of different ways of doing polls, and the barriers to entry into being a pollster are much lower today than they used to be because of this. But if you're trying to evaluate polling that, if you see poll results and you're trying to figure out, do I trust this? One question you can ask yourself and look at the methodology is, what are they doing about the sample? And so a number of the polls that you now see published are coming from these what are called probability-based panels, where people have been recruited. In our case, we use a mail survey sent to a random sample of addresses. And if people respond, then we say, would you like to join our panel? And if they join the panel, we ask them, do you have access to the internet? And if they don't, we provide them with a tablet and a data plan so that they can take part in our surveys. And if a pollster isn't doing that, then, you need to ask more questions about how they're assuring that their panel is actually representative of the population.
Rob Santos, we heard about all the different terminology being used to describe the people that are being surveyed. One of them I hear a lot is likely voters. X number of likely voters said they support this, that, and the other thing. What is a likely voter?
A likely voter is a prediction. So it actually isn't a population that exists that is out in the world. It's actually a pollster's prediction of who represents the type of person that will go to the polls and vote on election day. And it's a model, it's a statistical model that predicts this, and it's been used for many years in the polling industry. What's fascinating is that typically and necessarily those prediction models for likely voters are based on past performance. So in the past, who has actually voted? They take a look at that, they build a statistical model around that, and then they predict for this coming election who will be a likely voter. Now, interestingly, the world has changed. We saw that in 2016, and it has changed even more today in our COVID world, so to speak. That type of societal change fundamentally can affect the models for likely voters. Things like voter suppression. There are some states that are, you know, trying to have one single, you know, polling unit in a gigantic metro area.
You mean a voting site?
Going to court. Yeah, voting site. I'm sorry. To the extent that those types of activities and things like mail voting, if that suddenly becomes available for the nation, that's going to fundamentally change likely voter models. Who would be able to go out and vote will change drastically. And so we're in a period of high uncertainty, and that needs to be taken into account when we start seeing these different polls that start coming out. The polling will tell you what it can tell you about what's going on right now. It's a good way of taking a pulse, but it's not a good way of predicting life or death, so to speak, other than if your pulse doesn't exist, you're down and out. But keep in mind that there are things that affect likely voter models, and we're in the midst of a societal change due to COVID that is likely going to affect what that model looks like and how the ability of the pollsters to accurately predict who's going to vote.
And populations that typically did not participate in elections, are they becoming activated? Will they, and they say, I am now going to vote. I didn't vote before, but now I'm going to vote because of everything that is happening in national politics. Would that individual be missed, Rob Santos, by trying to round up and corral and monitor likely voters?
It's a crapshoot, so to speak, in that there is no way of accurately predicting the impact of the current societal changes on likely voters. One can make some guesstimates, and I'm sure that the pollsters are all out there, you know, trying to develop their models in that way. But we've seen it before. In the Obama years, there were people that had never voted before. A heavier amount of the younger crowd came out to vote. Then it didn't happen in 2016. Is it going to happen in 2018? It may or it may not. And how effective is that willingness to vote going to be in the face of voter suppression efforts? Who knows? And like I said, this is a time of uncertainty, and we need to keep that in mind when viewing the polls, because it'll tell you one thing versus the actual event of getting out and going to a polling location or sending in your mail absentee vote or whatever.
We're talking about polling science, what goes into creating a poll. How can we interpret those polls, avoid misinterpretation of the polls? What should we be listening to or reading about when we read about poll results in the media, in newspapers, and they have these terminologies like likely voter or gold standard or the latest presidential poll averages? Well, why are we averaging these polls? Which ones get included? Which ones get tossed out? Are polls, can they be manipulated? And are they fake? Do you rely on public opinion data when it comes to voting? Why or why not? Have you been influenced? Do you feel like, well, why should I go vote when I see the results already and they don't need my vote? And then that actually can change the outcome of the results. So are you skeptical about bias in polling and surveys? The number to call in is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The source continues right after this. Thank you. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about polling science, these numbers that they roll out during a newscast, and they'll tell you this candidate is leading that candidate in this state and that state. This state could flip, but then does it actually ever happen? How much faith should we have in the polling numbers? If you've got a question or a comment, 833-TPR-TALK, 833-877-8255. Do you actually read deep into these polling stories, or do you just take them at face value? Have you been influenced or swayed by these numbers, or do you really think that they're just a bunch of malarkey and shouldn't really be that given that much weight to it? So call in. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK, and we have Fernando on the line. Fernando, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hello. I've only heard of one known pollster, and how can you verify if they are credible or not? I mean, I don't know if I can say the pollster's name, but he's a national figure, so that's why I just wanted to verify.
Okay. Thank you, Fernando. So let's go to Rob Santos, Vice President and Chief Methodologist at the Urban Institute, President-elect of the American Statistical Association, and former President of the American Association of Public Opinion Researchers. It seems like I'm hearing from Fernando's question. It's like how much, what is the reputation of a particular poll or pollster, and how much do these polling outfits and these pollsters, how much do they worry about their reputation?
I would hope that they very much worry about their reputation, but there are actually a couple of ways that you can gauge the credibility and reputation of these pollsters. The first is that the American Association for Public Opinion Research actually has something called a transparency initiative. This is a registry where pollsters can get into it and profess that they will be transparent about their methodology, about the questions that they ask, and they will be willing to put their data out there to let people get an even closer look at some level. So if you go to APOR.org, A-A-P-O-R.org, you can look for the Transparency Initiative and see if your favorite pollster happens to appear on that. Part of the Transparency Initiative, which many pollsters, whether they're on the Transparency Initiative or not, they abide by, is by having a section that discusses their methodology. And their methodology for the polling would have things like who actually is it that was sampled? Where did they get the list from? So was it just anyone online who happens to come on board so people can multiply, you know, several times they can do the same interview? Or was it a sample of registered voters? Or is it a sample of the general population, et cetera? The other thing is that they will have tell you when the data were collected and some sense of the uncertainty associated with it. Things like a margin of error or alternatively a credibility interval, which is like a margin of error, but for situations where margins of error are inappropriate, you know, the plus or minus 2 or 3 points. Looking at that methodology statement would be a very good start, as well as looking to see if they're on the APOR Transparency Initiative. And oftentimes in that little paragraph, which is often cryptic in the polling data, there will be a link to a more detailed methodology that, you know, says, you know, was it online, telephone, in person, which really doesn't get done much these days. So take a look at that and do your due diligence. I mean, we're consumers. We don't just go to any doctor we want to. We look them up. We maybe look at Yelp or, you know, some other type of rating. We do our homework for simple things like restaurants and, you know, doctors and grocery stores. Why not do a little bit of our own due diligence for polling? That's a great way to help you properly consume these data.
Trent Buskirk, professor of data science and chair of the Applied Statistics and Operations Research Department at Bowling Green State University. So a lot of the polling that we see, public polling data that's released into the world and into the media, but then there's another world of polling, right? Private polling data. Candidates are doing their own polling, aren't they?
Yes, they certainly can. I was just going to add to Rob's response that sometimes when people survey you, or you get called, or you get asked a question about your, you know, your voting preferences and political candidates, you really should also pay very close attention to what people are telling you at the beginning of that phone call. There are things like, you know, people calling on behalf of fundraising for a candidate. Instead of actually asking you about your opinions about a candidate, they end up fundraising, right? So these are things called, what we call in the industry, called frugging. And so this would make you think, okay, are they really giving me a poll, or are they actually trying to raise money for a particular candidate?
Can you tell me that word again? Can you tell me that word again? I didn't really get it. What's it called?
Yeah, it's called frugging.
Frugging.
It's F-R-U-G-G-I-N-G. It's a fundraising under the guise of research. And so a lot of times you might see a political candidate calling and saying, we want to know about your opinion for the environment, or how you might think this particular candidate might support your causes. And then at the end of the call, they ask you to make a donation for that candidate. And this would seem like a poll at the beginning, but it really is more of a fundraising attempt. These are things that often get confused in the public, because they think they're being polled, and then at the very last minute, they're asked about donation opportunities. So these are things that we also would sort of think about in terms of what the credibility of that particular information might be. And also, you know, the same goes with whether the poll is released to the public or whether it's done privately, still being able to figure out who's doing the poll, right? Is it a Democratic pollster? Is it an independent pollster? Is it a Republican pollster? And are they screening for the kind of party candidate that you are? If a Democratic pollster is only screening out Democrats and they think that Biden will win the election, this might be troubling in terms of thinking about the accuracy of that information, because they didn't ask a single Republican who they might vote for. Or it could be a Republican pollster doing the exact same thing. The point of the matter is, knowing the slant of the polling organization can also help with the interpretation of the denominator and sort of who they're screening and what their statistics are really portending. Is this just a description of the Democrats, or is this a description of the electorate in general, for example?
Trent Buskirk, there's Fox News poll. So Fox News obviously has a slant towards a conservative ideology in their product, but they have a Fox News poll, and people wonder about how straight is that poll.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the methodology, but as Rob said, there are often opportunities to vet this. You know, another resource that could be helpful there is 538.com. A lot of these pollster aggregators do have grading reports that actually give you a history of how that poll has stacked up relative to the elections that it was predicting. This is also very helpful, given that people do multiple polls for a single election over time. But as you mentioned, right, I would think that a FoxNews.com poll might be very similar to, say, let's say I wanted to poll people about their opinion of U.S. football, and I got all of the polls, I got all of my participants from tennis.com. One might ask, lots of people who go to tennis.com may actually like football, but it may not be completely representative of the entire electorate. And there might be a voter registration model that would try to compensate for that, but it's very hard to compensate for liberal-minded people on a FoxNews.com poll if they screen all those people out, or those people don't have a chance to be included. So I think these questions about representation and about screening and about sort of the targets where these polls are aiming to get their respondents is really important, regardless of if it's FoxNews.com poll or whether it's a CNN poll or whether it's a CNBC poll. The methodology and the rigor and the questions I would ask are all the same.
Rob Santos, my understanding is a Fox News poll that they read on their TV, on their channel, is actually pretty straight and fair, isn't it?
That's my understanding, although I have not dove into the exact methodology, but they seem fairly reputable.
When so
I can speak to that if,
okay,
if you're interested. So they use a bipartisan team. They have a Democratic pollster and a Republican pollster who collaborate on the polls. That's a model that's used by other news organizations such as NBC News and the Wall Street Journal. The theory there being that, you know, it's unlikely that either partner would allow something to be done in the methodology that would disadvantage their side, as it were. And so, you know, it's an interesting model. It's no guarantee that the results will be accurate, but it is a way to assure consumers that there's a basic fairness to the way the thing is put together. And it is interesting, you know, the Fox News poll has not been particularly good for President Trump lately, and in fact he's criticized them a couple of times. And so, you know, I think I know the people who do that poll, and I think they do a good job and try very hard. And I would say that about, you know, the other major news organizations, because they have a lot on the line. You know, if they're wrong, everybody knows it.
Yeah, eventually there will be an election, and we'll be able to compare how right or how wrong were these predictions. I don't know if there actually are predictions, but people try to turn them into predictions. We can talk more about that when we come back from the break. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Chris, hang on. I'll get you on right after this break. If you have a question or a comment about polling and how it impacts politics, call in 833-TPR-TALK. We'll be right back. Back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're taking a deep dive into polling science this afternoon. You're going to be hearing a lot about polls between now and November the 3rd, and you have to try and figure out which ones are actually an indicator of something, but what exactly? We're going to be talking about that. Call in. The number is 833-877-8255. Let's get to Chris on the phones. Chris, thanks for calling in. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. I've got a kind of a question with like a little side piece. You know, what does a poll mean? And can anyone use the word poll if it is just, in fact, say, a series of questions? I'm on the president's email list, and I get poll after poll of, you know, he wants to know what his supporters think or however you want to look at it. But like an example of a question, do you think the media has failed to accurately report on the extreme rhetoric of Democrat leaders over the past month? If that's a poll question, I mean, how is that not completely leading? If you're not an attorney, you can't claim to be an attorney. If you're not a cop, you can't claim to be a cop. If it's not a true poll, can you claim it to be a poll? That's kind of my question.
All right, Chris, thank you for that. So that sounds like a push poll question. We can talk about that. So Rob Santos, how do you get to, can you just throw the word poll around and just use it?
People actually do just use the word poll, meaning many different things. Part of it has to, the issue is what's the purpose of the poll if Biden or Trump want to ask their supporters, and not necessarily a random sample of the supporters, how do they feel about a particular issue? They can get information that really is not statistical, but can tell them the types of things that their supporters are worrying about. That's different than the current population survey by the Bureau of Labor Statistics doing a gold standard national survey to find out what the employment rate is, because there you need highly accurate, statistically rigorous estimates of unemployment so that policies that affect millions of people can get made. So there's a big difference in terms of the word poll. Technically, a poll is any type of sample, whether it's rigorous or not, whether it's scientific or not, where you gather information so that you can do something with it. The big issue is, what do you want to do with it, and does it align with a purpose for which you're doing that. So there's lots of examples where non-rigorous, non-statistical polling, like the one that Shetland mentioned, are used in ways that are not appropriate. And we have to be able to decipher that as consumers of these types of polls.
Scott Keeter at the Pew Research Center, this is something that Chris alluded to and was also something I brought up. What exactly are we supposed to take away from these poll results? Are there, we want them to be predictions, but they're not, correct?
Well, I think that there's a little semantic game that sometimes goes on. We do polls because there's a tremendous amount of interest in what the public's thinking. And, you know, here I'd broaden the notion just a little bit to go beyond whether you're supporting one candidate or another to questions about whether you support government shutdowns of certain businesses for public health reasons or requirements that people wear masks. And so, you know, those the polling that could really be useful to us is polling that helps us to eliminate what the public is thinking at any given time. And that's not necessarily making a prediction, but the fact is, if you're doing polls about elections, you are at least hinting of the possibility of how the election is going to turn out. And so, you know, I think for us to say, well, polls are just snapshots in time, that's absolutely true. But the fact is, people want to know where the race stands. They want to know what public opinion is at a given time about issues that are important and on which people disagree. And those things can have consequences on, you know, how legislatures act, how executives, you know, make policy, and ultimately they can make a difference in how people vote and whether they vote.
And Trent Buskirk at Bowling Green State University, another important thing that Chris brought up was the wording of a poll. Sometimes it's obvious that it is a push poll and they're trying to actually influence public opinion with these so-called polling efforts. And sometimes these poll questions are loaded. They may be asking you, do you think that we should be helping people who lost their jobs in COVID-19 fallout? Or they should be saying, should unemployed people get back to work? You know, it depends on how you phrase a question. So when you look at a poll to evaluate whether or not it is fair and accurate and something, should we be looking at how the questions were written?
Yeah, it's a really good point. In fact, I was going to chime in earlier, but I'm glad you asked the question. So, you know, if you ever go to a restaurant, right, and you're sitting at the table and you're eating your food, this is, I guess, a throwback to when we were doing that. You know, you get a manager that comes over to your table and they might say, your service was great tonight, I trust. Or, did you have any problems tonight? You know, or the food was good. And this sort of leading kind of question really generally means that people nod and say, oh, it was great or it was fine. And you very rarely get the other response. Similarly, similar things can happen. I think the question that the call posed was a really interesting one in terms of the email question that he received. Because that really sounds like a pretty loaded question in my mind. It is you can kind of see what side of the tally marks the asker of the question really wants to see a response. And so I often think that, you know, if polls are going to be meaningful and helpful, they have to really be objective, as Scott and Rob have already talked about. It's not only the method by which the sample is conducted, but it's also the questions by which, the respondents or the voters are asked. And this is important not only for evaluating one poll, but it's also important for looking at multiple polls, because there are multiple polls, as you've mentioned multiple times on the program so far. There are multiple people doing these polls, and if one pollster asks the question slightly differently than another pollster, that could actually affect the results that we post. And when we compare the variability across polls, some of that variability is within the sample-to-sample variations that Rob mentioned, but others of that variability could be explained by the differences in the way the questions are asked, or the differences in the order of the questions. You know, an example about 2016 that we didn't speak about earlier is that, you know, Trump was in a lot of the telephone samples where there was an interviewer present, and the interviewer asked, do you support Trump for the election? Many people who would otherwise vote for Trump would not say publicly in front of an interviewer that they supported Trump. But in online polls where there was no interviewer and we asked a similar question, you saw an uptick in the response for Trump. And you have to ask yourself, how is that different? Similar question, but different response patterns. Part of this also has to do with the presence or absence of an interviewer and whether people feel comfortable answering truthfully about one of the options that is posed to them. This is another kind of consideration to think about in terms of comparing polls as well, because online polls can be different from telephone polls simply because we might be asking sensitive questions, similar to what Scott was saying about masks.
Sure.
Some people just have a visceral response to masks among corona. If you ask me in person in an online poll if I'm going to wear a mask and I really don't like masks, I might be okay to admit to you that I'm not going to wear a mask.
Right.
But if I have to admit to a person out loud that I'm not going to wear a mask in a state that is really clamping down on mask use.
I want to cut you off. I want to get this last caller in. So I'm almost out of time. Ginny, welcome to The Source. You're on the air. Ginny, go ahead.
Hi. I'm sorry if this is like a Captain Obvious type question, but when it comes to polls, why don't we just look at who has the best track record, like who's gotten it right the most times in presidential elections or senatorial elections or what have you? And secondly, do we know who wins? You know, who's gotten it right? What polling organization has gotten it right most frequently?
Okay.
And if so, like, where can we find that information?
All right. So Rob Santos, Ginny, thank you for the question. Rob Santos, what about Ginny's question?
It's a great question. And I would respond with something that Edwards Deming used to say about quality control. You can have a process like polling, multiple polls, that can all be equally good, but there's a red bean. And if you just throw out one red bean randomly to one of those polls, boom, it happens to be right on. The point being that from poll to poll, there can be variability that through the sources that Trent talked about, question wording, the way the data were collected, the way the sample was, how the data were adjusted, that makes by chance one of the polls better on a given occasion or in a given week than another. Putting together a string of who did the best, who was most accurate over X weeks, can be an exercise in just coin flipping in random events. And there could be a string of lucky pollsters that the very next poll could be absolutely disastrous for them. So
right.
I would really caution on just looking at the methodology and sticking with your buyer beware paradigm.
And they say that's why we actually have elections, to really see what the actual poll that matters is, who turns out, who casts their ballots, and who gets the most at the end of the day. I want to thank all of our guests for helping us understand polling science a lot better. Rob Santos, Vice President and Chief Methodologist at Urban Institute and the President-elect of the American Statistical Association. Also, Trent Buskirk, the Professor of Data Science and the Chair of the Applied Statistics and Operations Research Department at Bowling Green State University. And Scott Keeter, Senior Survey Advisor at the Pew Research Center. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks so much for tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.